Position number 21583, room 4.
Frank Moore, room 4.
And we could hear his tracks grunching away outside the church. And it had opened fire on this Regiment A position. And we had a Lance Bombardier medical orderly and the Padre. And they, I believe, got a sheet and made a red cross probably out of blood. And they went out. And this Bombardier bawled out the German tank commander and said, "Do you realize you're shooting at the wounded people?" And give the German tank commander his due. I mean, he was obviously civilized, and he said, "Right, providing people don't shoot from that building, I will not shoot at it." And this was a sort of verbal shouting match between the two enemies, as it were. And the medical bombardier was extremely brave to go out something like that and face a tank, because a German tank was the most terrifying damn thing. If you knew you had nothing, you could knock it out with. We had a survey officer called Rod Pearson, who I can give you his address, and he's up in Durham. He's a very interesting man, because he survived a parachute that didn't open when in training, and he fought a wonderful battle. He was our survey officer, and he was cited for an MC, and like so many others, people didn't get it because of the rationing of it. And he became a parson. He always gets cross because people say, "Did you become a parson because you survived a parachute that didn't open?" I've got a Roman candle. And he says, no, his motive was totally genuine. Terribly nice man, and he's still alive, and he's well worth talking to about his experiences. Very nice man. And he was fighting around the church, and I think firing with machine gun with another officer, brother officer of mine, called John Widdicombe, who's now in Australia. And he was, I think, firing at tanks with a Bren gun from part of the rubble of the church. But it was a pretty messy sort of business, because on the other troop, the easy troop, there was a tragic accident. One of the glider pilots walked in front of one of our guns just as he was firing. He was killed instantly, and two of the gun detachment were killed. And the gun position officer, who was badly wounded and taken prisoner, of course, and had a rough time and is still rather disfigured, he had a German soldier fall in on top of him in the gun position on his little gun, his command post. It was so, it was so mixed up. The Germans virtually were in and amongst us, and the only thing you could do tries to keep the infantry out, because you couldn't do much about the tanks. One of our guns, I remember, when a German tank came around, he had a view up the road towards Arnhem, and they were all prepared. They were taking post, and we gave the order, sort of open fire over open sights. And he knocked the tank out. I remember this colleague of mine, Tom Conlin, shouting out, sort of, "Well done, Mac." He'd fired shot up a tank. And then the Germans got into a house almost at the edge of our gun position. And we used a phosphorus smoke shell, which we had some, to fire into that house and set it on fire. but this was virtually on the edge of the gun position. It's this little meadow. I mean, it was close to sort of hand-to-hand fighting, really. But you know, they put their armour in, and they kept their infantry for sort of mopping up, but which they planned to do obviously the next day. But it was a very confused battle because you didn't know what was going on anywhere except just in your own little bit. And we didn't even know where the other part of the regiment was. They were quite close. And we lost all the officers of one troop. One friend of mine who lost an eye got a DSO as a subaltern. We probably recommended for a VC, but personally sort of manhandling them with guns and shooting at German tanks. And you had no protection. You were sort of there. If you were doing that sort of thing, you were just sort of visible to the enemy, very visible. And our chaps were good. We had a very, very nice letter, I think it was, from a Major Kane, who got a VC virtually on our gun position and on another troop's gun position, saying how impressed his men were that when our gunners, we said take post, and they were exposed and firing their guns, and they were, you know, totally unprotected virtually. They were not in slip trenches, they were manning the guns, and they had no gun shields or anything like that. And every time they responded, anyway, I think that when I got back into this field dressing station, I was put in an ambulance, and the ambulance had to cross the bridge at Nijmegen, which was still being shelled at the time, so they sort of put their foot on the accelerator and to cross, and I was in some place in Nijmegen, I think for a couple of nights, which was obviously a sort of field dressing station. But they couldn't move us down because the Germans had cut the road further south, because we had landed 63 miles into enemy territory, and of course virtually the Second Army had to come up one road, and they were pretty primitive roads in those days, and nothing like motorways or dual carriageways. And of course there was an awful snarl up, and the Germans were attacking, and they cut the road. Then I got an ambulance down to Brussels, and there was a field dressing station there, and it was on the airfield, and I was put in an aeroplane with stretchers in it, and flown back to England a few days afterwards. Funnily enough, I could lean over and look out of the window, and I noticed just as we flew over my old school, Wellington, I suddenly recognized, good God, I know where we are. We landed back in almost the same airfield, and I went to a hospital to Penarth in near Cardiff, and I wasn't, I say, badly wounded. I slept for about 48 hours. I mean, one didn't realize how tired one was. And then I was given a new pair of trousers because they had to cut my trousers off. But I was fit enough to walk into the town. And that was tragic because you couldn't walk 100 yards before somebody coming up saying, "Where you darling?" Yes. You didn't know what happened to my brother or my son, or, and of course you didn't know what happened to anybody, you didn't know what happened to your own men, and you couldn't give any help. It's awful. Anyway, I got back to my regiment a few weeks later, and I think I'd had some leave. I'd had some sick, a week's leave. And the regiment reformed. Well, it took a long time. They didn't know what to do with us. For a while we were, you know, the division was, had, well, if you'd lose 8,000 men out of 10,000 or 12,000, you haven't got much left. And it took an awful lot of time to reform. And the thing that rather got up our nose was that when we were in North Africa, our commanding officer got us together and said, some of you are regulars. Not many of us were. I think only about 6 out of 50 officers were regulars. But he said, some of you feel you should have promotion. He says, there's no promotion in the airborne artillery because there's only 2 regiments, really, very little promotion, unless we have casualties. But he said, if any of you want to, you know, feel you should get promoted elsewhere, he said, I won't hold it against you if you ask to put in for it and get into another field unit. But he said, I will promise you that if we do have casualties, I've got enough talent that I will promote from within. Well, he was, I say, wounded and taken prisoner, badly wounded. And we lost quite a number. And one regular major was made colonel. One regular captain was made major, and I think perhaps a couple of subalterns were made captains. And everybody else was brought in, more or less anybody's friends from GHQ Middle East or something like that, who we got some of them very good. We had a very, very nice man called Pat Porteous who got a VC in Dieppe, I think it was, Ray. He joined the regiment, and you couldn't find a nicer chap. But it did get up our nose that they felt they had to bring in people to fill the vacancies where when we had people who had been in the regiment from the beginning, virtually, that might have had some of the promotion, and we had some very good men who would have been capable of it. I remember writing a letter to the Times, which they didn't publish, because that was, if you remember, in the Falklands War, when Colonel Jones was killed, they flew in. They didn't promote the second command. They had to fly somebody else in. I thought, what a mistake. Personally, I mean, he may have been a very good man, but the fighting soldiers there, they'd far rather have someone who'd been through their experiences than somebody who hadn't. Anyway, we reformed, and after a while, we messed around until Christmas, and then they decided to reform us, and we went to, we did some retraining and airborne training. And near the end of the war, we moved all our aircraft and so on down to Essex from Gloucestershire, and we loaded up, weren't briefed, and we reckoned that we were going to fly to Berlin, and perhaps Churchill had decided that we would do this, and maybe Roosevelt stopped him because the Russians were supposed to get there first. But we were really quite excited. We were going to have another go. The Rhine crossing had taken place. The war was almost coming to an end. And we were locked up in this air transit camp, obviously for an operation. And then it was cancelled, and we went on an exercise, and one of the brigades, I think, was supposed to be the enemy. That disappeared, and actually the war was ending, and they flew into Copenhagen. I think it was the 1st Parachute Brigade flew into Copenhagen. And then the war ended, and we, the day after, I think the day was May the 8th, I think the 9th or the 10th, we flew into Stavanger in Norway. and liberated Stavanger, and that was absolutely sort of marvelous in a way. For a month we were rounding the Germans up. The Germans were very unhelpful. They felt they'd been let down by troops who weren't in Scandinavia, because they'd had a pretty isolated, easy time, and they were a fairly arrogant lot. Stavanger Harbour was a big harbour, and it was full of German destroyers and E-boats and things. We mounted a Bren gun and a Piat on a little island and said to the Germans, you know, you move your ships, we'll open fire on you. But you know what a Bren gun would have done against an E-boat. Well, I believe that there was a naval attaché attached, and he gave permission for an E-boat to be moved, and he didn't tell our people, and I think they opened up, and unfortunately for them, two of the Germans was killed because they moved their E-boat without our knowing that they'd been given permission. But my troop took over a German food store, and we weren't allowed to touch the food, but it had 14,000 bottles of brandy, or wine brand, and schnapps in it, so we took 4,000 bottles out quick in case any of the base swallows or the naffy got hold of it, and we used to sort of put 20 bottles in the back of a car if we went out, liberated car, when we went out to party and things in the evening with the Norwegians. And I remember we had arranged a dance with a village. The Norwegians were wonderful to us, you know, they were, but we had a dance. And in Norway, they hadn't had any alcohol really at all during the war. So we said to them, you send up and we'll give you some booze. And we gave them 200 bottles. And when we went down to the village hall for the dance, there was no bottles there. So we sent back and for another 200 bottles. Meanwhile, the Norwegians, what we'd given them, arrived. So there were 400 bottles of neat spirits, no glasses, no water, no nothing to mix with them. And I remember seeing the drummer, I think, sort of drinking this neat spirit, sort of eyes going out in every direction, and his foot went through the big drum. And there was no bad behavior, but there were people passing out everywhere, as you can imagine. And so the next morning, my troop commander said to me, he said, we'll get the troops on, Major, and you and I will go and apologize to the Norwegian for our chaps sort of passing out everywhere. And just at that moment, the mayor of the village and some of his colleagues came up to apologize for the Norwegians passing out. So we had to open another bottle to sort of celebrate that. But that was the sort of spirit. It was, you know, we'd survived the war. It was fun. We'd wrapped the Germans up, as it were. They were sending them back. And you felt an incredible feeling of sort of couldn't care less, in a way, that you survived. Anyway, we went, the regiment came back on a troop ship back to Southampton, and we were moved to a place called Oddstock near Salisbury, which was an American hospital. I think it's now Isa Hospital. And we were disbanded, and I was too young to get out of the army at that time. This is 1945. I tried to get into Aero-P, which was flying these little Oster planes, which I was accepted for, because although I wasn't a regular, I just had enough time. And then I failed my flying medical because I'm colorblind, and I was very upset about that. So I was offered promotion to captain if I would go to Germany, or if I would go to India, and I said, I don't want to go to Germany. I think nothing worse than trying to control a defeated nation. And I don't want to go to India because I think the Indians should have their own, you know, should run the, have their own freedom, you know, independence. And I can think of nothing worse than trying to keep the Indians down, because although things were happening in that direction, you know, Churchill was saying, throwing the empire away and that sort of thing. And I was then was allowed to have a choice, and I could join the Independent Parachute Company, the Pathfinder Parachute Company, which belonged to the 1st Airborne Division, which was being posted to the 6th Airborne Division as a unit. And of course, 6th Airborne Division were virtually already in Palestine, so we sort of joined them sort of rather late. I was only a couple of days in their base at Tisbury, and a lot of the original people had were not joining, not carrying on. They were, had done enough service to be released and not go out to Palestine. And for my sins, I went out to Palestine, which I loathed. I was there about a year, just over. The only thing, I met my wife at the Cedars of Lebanon. She was on sick leave, and we called it a ski course. The parachute regiment had fiddled it. And
why did you loathe it in Palestine?
I'm sorry, what?
Why did you loathe it in Palestine?
The internal security duties were, I think, an absolute pain. We were up against... We went out, to be honest with you, probably 100% sympathetic with the Jews. Within 3 months, I think we were 100% sympathetic with the Arabs, because it was the Jews who were shooting at us. Sometimes we were dressed in British uniform. They shot six of our, one of the parachute battalions who were asleep in the car park, you know. They hung a couple of sergeants. You know, it wasn't all of them, but the, I mean, the Stern Gang and the IZL, as they're called, were pretty brutal. And I always felt they could teach the IRA a thing or two. But also, I got the impression of the Middle East of being dirt and dead donkeys. It was a lousy type job to do, and night patrols around a detention camp at Latrun. We were in a little camp there. I ran an armored train up and down the line, from a railway line from Lida to Gaza and back. We never quite knew what the purpose was, because we felt if the Jews had blown the bridge, the Cairo Express would be in on top of us about 5 minutes later. But I found it very tiresome. And then I went on this course. We say there were about 400 men and 6 women. I might have exaggerated that, and I'm met my wife on the last evening and got on the same truck going down to Tripoli, the base camp, and I ran out of money, so I went to the officers' club and I sold my drawers, woolen long, and vests, woolen, to the barman for 30 shillings, which was enough to get us to a nightclub, and an Arab nightclub, as it were, and had some evening. And then she had to go back to Cairo, and I thought, Paris, so sadly, I said, I met this wonderful girl. Anyway, some weeks later, she rang me up, and she'd come back to Palestine, so I rushed up to see her, and then took her out. And anyway, I asked her to marry me on my, I think, my 5th meeting, and she said, ask me again when you're sober, which... I thought the next night I did ask her, and she said yes. I mean, she was, I wasn't that, I was quite high, and she, but I mean, quite sort of steamed up. And I remember going into the mess. We were stationed on an RAF station at Castina, I think it was called. And there was a group captain there, and I said, I've just got engaged to this wonderful girl in the world, and all that sort of thing. And he said, you bloody fool, you damned idiot, there's a shortage of women around here. He was just getting his divorce, of course, so he had a rather soured view on marriage. And as we had our golden wedding about 4 years ago, I'm sorry he wasn't around and I couldn't ask him. But anyway, that was the only good thing that came out of Palestine. And I did all sorts of things, like I hitchhiked in an aeroplane to go to Cairo to see her. I say hitchhike, it was a regular aeroplane, but I asked a pilot and he said, as we take off from Castina, he said, if to Lida, pick up the passengers, if you chuck yourself in the lavatory, and then when we're on our way to Cairo, walk out, nobody will know you, and you're not an official passenger. He said, when you get to Cairo, you're on your own. And so we had a nice leave there, and I'd run out of money by the end, and I was threatened that if I didn't get back to my company the next morning, I'd be court-martialed for absence of that leave. And so I managed to hitchhike an army truck back, just get back in time without to have a shave and get on parade. But it was the days that you thought, again, I wasn't going to be staying in the army. I was just sort of, you felt very carefree. And then I fiddled, my brother-in-law helped, and I had to defer my release, and I came up and ended my army career instructing at the Gunner Octu at Deep Cut. So my last 18 months, that's the end of my...
What battery and troop were you in at Arnhem?
I was in a fox troop of 3 battery, which all the other 2 batteries, they were all very good. They were always envious of our battery because we had originally this little dynamic tiny Madden as our battery commander. And the original regiment had started from a battery which was commanded by Pat Lloyd, who is actually was brother of Christopher Lloyd, who writes all this gardening article for The Country Life and so on. And he's a very well-known gardener and so on. Pat Lloyd was very, very sort of, I'd say, prim, but he had a dry mess, no alcohol in the mess. And when Tiny Madden joined, and he graduated from Woolwich, he was a regular soldier, he said, this is absolute bloody nonsense, can't have this. And so we had almost the opposite, because the day I joined my regiment, we went into the mess trying to remember whether you took your Sam Brown off or not, you know, an officer's mess. Got there in the afternoon, suddenly the door burst open. One captain, I think it was, leapt over the sofa, kicked it back, followed by several with soda water siphons trying to squirt him with soda water. And sort of one crazy thing, I remember we had a long table. I mean, there were about 50-something officers with long, long table. And we got one friend of mine. They said, Sam, bicycle, get on your bicycle and bicycle down the mess table. And Sam had unfortunately bicycled off the edge and cracked his head on the door, and everybody thought it was a great laugh. And I remember going into this awful little huts we had. It was a very old First World War camp, Bulford camp, and one subaltern I never met, who was the one who was badly injured in my battery at Arnhem. He said he'd been out on the downs trying to shoot rabbits, and he said, I think I made an awful thing. He said, I couldn't see anything to shoot, so I shot at something as a sort of target. And he said, I think it was the mustard gas container. And and people were firing pistols through the hut roofs to hear them trickle down to see if they would actually get through the roof, because the 38 pistols were very rough. So it was a madcap outfit, but lovely.